The staff and volunteers at CJSF wish you a joyful Kwanzaa and a happy new year.
Beginning in 2008, the people of Gaza undergo a succession of brutal Israeli massacres. The first major massacre occurs in 2008. Israel killed about 1,200 Gazans, including 350 children. It destroyed approximately 6,300 homes, and it decimated the infrastructure of Gaza. And then in 2014, the most savage of the massacres in Gaza, it was called Operation Protective Edge. At the time, the head of state was Benjamin Netanyahu.
That's Norman Finkelstein, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Norman Finkelstein, a brief history of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. The world's eyes are on Gaza now. It is ruled by Hamas. Hamas is an acronym in Arabic for Islamic Resistance Movement. A bit of history. Gaza came under Israeli military control in 1967. That continued for 38 years until 2005. Since then, it has been subjected to an Israeli-imposed siege and blockade and a series of bloody wars, which Israel says, in self-defense, is responding to Hamas rocket attacks. But nothing compares to the death and destruction of the current conflict. More than 10,000 Palestinians and 1,400 Israelis have been killed. Without a knowledge of history, we are susceptible to manipulation. To give background is not to condone or excuse savagery on either side. It's to provide understanding of the origins of the conflict. As UN Secretary General Guterres said, the attacks by Hamas did not happen in a vacuum. Our guest today is Norman Finkelstein. He's a distinguished independent scholar and author of many books. He's long focused on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. He's the subject of the documentary film American Radical. He spoke in mid-October. And now, Norman Finkelstein.
In as succinct a way as possible, I'm going to run through the history of the Israel-Palestine conflict with a focus, as I proceed, to the Gaza part of the Israel-Palestine conflict. And to just give a rudimentary picture of what is Gaza. Gaza is 25 miles long, it's 5 miles wide. Gaza is inhabited by 2.1 million people. Of those 2.1 million people, 70% are refugees or descendants of refugees. Half of Gaza comprises children. Gaza is among the most densely populated places on God's earth. It's more densely populated than Tokyo. So when you hear Israel saying it wants to empty out the northern sector, your imagination should conjure the image of among the most densely populated places on earth now becoming twice as densely populated. Nobody can go into Gaza. Nobody can get out of Gaza, with the rarest exceptions. You have a medical condition, very difficult to get out. If you don't have a medical condition, you're not getting out. And also, economically, 50% of Gaza is unemployed. Among youth, it's 60% are unemployed. I should mention, humanitarian organizations have described half the population as being suffering from severe food insecurity, which is to say about half of Gaza suffers not from the starvation, but suffers from daily hunger. If you put all the pieces together, you have a blockade that's lasted now for about 2 decades. Nobody goes in, nobody goes out, with the rarest of exceptions. Half the population is unemployed. Among youth, it's 60%. Half of the population is chronically suffering from hunger. When you add all those pieces together, it doesn't come altogether as a surprise that the conservative prime minister of the UK, David Cameron, described Gaza as, quote, an open-air prison. Now, one of Israel's most eminent sociologists, Baruch Kimberling, at the Hebrew University in Jerusalem, he since passed, but he described Gaza as, quote, the largest concentration camp ever. Somewhere between open-air prison, one pole of the spectrum, and largest concentration camp ever, that's Gaza. The young men who burst through the gates of Gaza on October 7th, probably, almost certainly, that was the first time they had ever breathed free air. They were born into a concentration camp, if you use Professor Kimmerling's terminology, or they were born into a prison. That, I think, is the essential background for trying to understand the unfolding of events since October 7th. There are obviously three dimensions beginning October 7th. The first dimension is the factual side. What happened? Some aspects of it remain murky, but the general picture, I think, is more or less clear. There'll be more precision in detail, but I don't think there'll be any great revelations. Then there is the legal side. What does Israel have the right to do under international law, and what doesn't it have the right to do? And then there is the moral side. And as you all know, law often lags behind morality. And so the moral dimension is not synonymous with the legal dimension. So, the history. There is always a kind of partisanship embedded in deciding where to begin. Some people want to begin with the kingdom of Judea some 2,000 years ago. Other people want to begin with the Arab inhabitation of Palestine and the Zionist settlers who came over to displace them. For reasons of time, I'm going to forgo either or both of those starting points, and I'll choose my own arbitrary, and I admit it to be arbitrary, starting point, departure point. There were two communities in Palestine by 1947. There was a Jewish community. It went by the title of the Yeshuv, and it constituted roughly 600,000 Jews, or Zionists, whichever term you prefer. And the second community consisted of Arabs, or if you prefer, Palestinian Arabs. And that community amounted to roughly 1,300,000. Since the early part of the 20th century, there was some cooperation, but mostly, I think it's fair to say, there was a competition and a conflict between the indigenous population of Palestine at the time, the Palestinian Arabs, and the Jewish settlers or colonizers. At the time it was called the Jewish Colonization Society. Jewish colonizers, there was a competition, and eventually that competition became a full-fledged conflict. It was clear after World War II that a resolution to the conflict had to be found. And originally the issue was managed by the British, what was called the British Mandate over Palestine. After World War II, the British despaired of finding a resolution to this conflict between the Jewish and the Arab communities. And so they threw the ball, so to speak, into the court of the United Nations. The United Nations sent over several fact-finding committees. The British had their own fact-finding committee. There was a large number of voluminous, and I would say quite impressive reports that were produced. And at some point, the General Assembly had to find some sort of resolution. And that resolution came in the form of UN Resolution 181. It's sometimes called the Partition Resolution. And the Partition Resolution, you can say, I think it's fair to say, it wasn't attempting to find a formula based on justice. It wasn't a moral inquiry or a moral resolution. It was very much approached as a practical, pragmatic problem. There are these two communities here. They don't get along. Their fundamental aspirations differ in fundamental ways. And there doesn't seem to be any prospect that they can get along. And so the decision was made by the majority. The majority opinion was to partition Palestine between those two communities, the Palestinian Arab and the Zionist Jewish communities. According to the partition, the Jewish community would comprise approximately 56% of Palestine. That is to say, 56% was allocated to the Jewish community, even as the population was 600,000, and 44% was allocated to the Arab population, even as its population was about 1,300,000. Well, the Arab side formally did not accept the partition resolution on two grounds. Ground number one, they were the indigenous population. Ground number two, they were the majority population. The Jewish side formally accepted the partition, but they were still determined to control or gain territorial control over the whole land of Israel, which the Zionist movement regarded as belonging to it. In any event, the conflict quickly degenerated after the partition resolution. It quickly degenerated into open warfare, not just between the two communities in Palestine, but also with the neighboring Arab states. As a consequence of that warfare, what's sometimes called the First Arab-Israeli War, there were two basic results which bear on the conflict today. The first result was there was a mass expulsion from the area that became Israel. There was a mass expulsion of the Palestinian Arab population. Roughly, the estimates are roughly 90% of the population within the area that became Israel. Roughly 90% of the population was expelled, and of that, it comprised about 750,000 Palestinian Arabs. Of those 750,000, roughly 250,000 Palestinians were expelled from the area that became Israel, and they ended up, of the 750,000, about a third of the 750,000 who were expelled, they ended up in Gaza. And they overwhelmed numerically the actual population, Arab population in Gaza. The bottom line there, and here I'm going to just fast forward to the present and then get back to where we were. The bottom line is Gaza is overwhelmingly a refugee population. So roughly 70% of the people of Gaza are classified under international law as refugees or descendants of refugees. So one fact you have to always bear in mind when you hear the word Gaza, that the population of Gaza is overwhelmingly a refugee population, and that overwhelming refugee population, they began, so to speak, their life in Gaza already as refugees. So when you hear now in the news about the possibility of an ethnic cleansing of Gaza, for about 70% refugees and descendants of refugees, we're talking about a twice over expulsion. Okay, let's go back to right after the 1948 war. I said there were two major consequences for our purposes. First, the mass expulsion. And secondly, Israel, now it's declared itself a state, Israel did not abide by the UN resolution of 56% being allocated to it. It expanded its borders to 80% of Palestine. The only areas of the what's called British-mandated Palestine, the only areas that did not come under Israeli control were what's called the West Bank, including East Jerusalem, and the Gaza Strip. With those two exceptions, the West Bank, including East Jerusalem, and the Gaza Strip, Israel now controlled all of historic or British-mandated Palestine. Now, for reasons of time, we're going to fast forward from 1948 to 1967. In 1967, there was another conflict between Israel and its Arab neighbors. It's sometimes called the Six-Day War. I prefer the June 1967 war. During the June 1967 war, Israel now expanded its borders a second time, and it now controlled the whole of the West Bank, including East Jerusalem, and the Gaza Strip. And those two areas, the West Bank, including East Jerusalem, and the Gaza Strip, under international law, constituted occupied territories. And there is a large body of international law on the legal status, the rights and duties of an occupying power in the course of its occupation. They are usually embodied in what's called the Hague Regulations and the Fourth Geneva Convention. Now, just as in 1947, the United Nations again came to play a major role in trying to find a solution to this seemingly intractable problem. The problem was first debated and disputed in the UN General Assembly. A resolution couldn't be found, and then it was thrown into the court of the UN Security Council. And the UN Security Council in November 1967 produced what's still considered the landmark resolution after 181 in 1947, the second landmark resolution, which still constitutes under international law the legal basis for trying to resolve the conflict, they produced or passed without any dissenting votes unanimously UN Resolution 242. UN Resolution 242 had two prongs. Prong number one was the international law principle based in the UN Charter and stated in the preambular paragraph to UN Resolution 242. Preambular paragraph simply means the preamble. And the preamble to UN Resolution 242 states, quote, "It's inadmissible to acquire territory by war. In accordance with that principle, Israel was obliged to relinquish control of the territories it had acquired during the 1967 war. Those territories being," and again, I'll beg your indulgence, but for my repeating myself, but unless you get the basic facts, everything else is just mystical. So let me again reiterate the basic facts. Under international law, it being inadmissible to acquire territory by war, Israel was legally bound under international law to relinquish control of the West Bank, including East Jerusalem, and the Gaza Strip. That you might call the quid in the quid pro quo. Quid pro quo, basically, your obligation, their obligation. The quo was, Israel is a state under international law. It's a member state of the United Nations, and therefore it has the same rights and duties as any other member state of the United Nations. And therefore, since the UN Charter calls for peaceful relations between states, the Arab states had the obligation to recognize Israel's right to live at peace with its neighbors. And those were the two, the mutually, the two preconditions for a resolution of the conflict. And it sometimes came to be called the land for peace terms for resolving the conflict. Israel had to relinquish the control over the territories it had acquired. The Arabs had to recognize Israel's right to live at peace with its neighbors in the region. I didn't mention the fact that in the course of the June 1967 war, Israel not only conquered the West Bank and Gaza, it also conquered the Egyptian Sinai, and it conquered the Syrian Golan Heights. I'm going to leave that aside. As I said, I want to hone in on why we're here today, namely the issue of Gaza. So that was the formula, full land, full withdrawal in exchange for a full peace. That was the formula that was presented by the UN, and it's still the Security Council, and it's still the basis for any resolution of the conflict. Beginning, now I'm going to now hone in just on the Palestinians, and I'll get to Gaza in a moment. The Palestinians at that point, their leadership was called the Palestine Liberation Organization. It was abbreviated the PLO, and the central figure, the key figure in the PLO, was a person named Yasser Arafat. Beginning in the early 1970s, the Palestine Liberation Organization signaled that it was prepared to accept the terms of UN Resolution 242. That is to say, it was prepared to recognize Israel as a state in the region with all the rights that accrue to a state, namely the right to live at peace with its neighbors. And the Palestinians demanded in return, and this was endorsed by the international community, the right, their right in return to exercise their self-determination as a people within the West Bank and Gaza, within that 20% of historic Palestine, which Israel was duty-bound to relinquish control over, and which the Palestinians now acquiesced would constitute the territorial borders of their state. So the Palestinians had, by the early 1970s, the Palestinians had met their duty, their obligation under international law to recognize Israel as a state, and they expected, as UN Resolution 242 stated, that then they would have their right. Having acknowledged their duty, they now wanted their right to exercise self-determination within the West Bank, including East Jerusalem and Gaza. The Israelis, on the other hand, were determined to keep all of what they regarded as their quote-unquote historic homeland, and they didn't want to relinquish control of large parts of the West Bank and any of Gaza. They were quite determined, and they dug in their heels not to accept those terms for resolving the conflict. International pressure then began to build on Israel to accept the Palestinian recognition of them as a state and to carry out a withdrawal from the territories they occupied. Come 1982, Israel came under a lot of pressure to acknowledge the Palestinian willingness to settle the conflict. What was called, there's a very good book, it's called Dilemmas of Security. And it's written by an Israeli political scientist who has since passed, named Avner Yaniv. And Avner Yaniv wrote in the book that Israel was faced with a major dilemma by the end of the 1970s and the early 80s. And now I'm using his term. He said the major dilemma was the Palestinian peace offensive, in quotation marks. The Palestinians were determined to settle the conflict in accordance with international law, but that would have compelled Israel to carry out a withdrawal from the territories which it considered belonged to it by historic right, and that it was not going to relinquish control of. In 1982, in June 1982, Israel contrived a casus belli, a pretext to launch a war in Lebanon, and in the course of that war, which began in 1982 and climaxed in September 1982, Israel killed, the estimates are, between 15 and 20,000 Palestinians, overwhelmingly civilians. After the war, or at the end of the war, climaxed in the major massacres of Palestinians in refugee camps in Lebanon. You can check it on your own, because there's a voluminous literature on it. It's called the Sabra and Shatila Massacres. At the end of the Sabra and Shatila massacres, the PLO was effectively defeated and it was forced into exile. At that point, we're talking about roughly 1982, there was a feeling that the Palestine question had now been eliminated. The Arab states and the international community took very little interest in it. And the people in the West Bank and Gaza were now left to what you might call their own devices. They realized there was not going to be any international pressure exerted on Israel, on the one hand, and on the other hand, unless they did something on their own, that is to say, took their fate into their own hands, this occupation would go on through eternity.
You're listening to Norman Finkelstein, a brief history of the Israeli-Palestinian